If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here in Inside the Ropes. We are back, and we're back here later in the week than we usually are. I'm Kenny, and I'm joined by Finn. Finn, I believe you've had a holiday, some much-deserved respite. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling all right, Kenny. Actually, to be honest with you, I had some appalling indigestion last night. I never suffer from this. I was up for about an hour in the middle of the night. I ended up having to watch Spy in the Wild, because it was like 2:30 in the morning, and I didn't want to wake up the neighbours. You know, I'm considerate of my neighbours, Kenny, in the middle of the night, unlike someone...
Here we go. You were happy to participate, Finn. You were happy to be there at the protest.
Hey, I tell you what, I bet those neighbours didn't say there was any Cumbrian voices among all that noise. I know who the main culprit was, and he's a guy who's a little bit taller than me with dark hair.
And he also may watch Thunder of a weekday.
Exactly.
But
apart from the indigestion, Kenny, I'm all right. I'm here. I'm fine. I'm fighting fit now. But I don't know what it was. I mean, anyway, I'm all right now. How are you doing, Kenny? How was your road trip this weekend?
It was fun. It was really good. JR was on top form. He was, at most points when he got the chance, he was kind of making fun of everybody that does, you know, leg slaps with wrestling moves.
Okay.
At all times. And, he was self-deprecating. He was fun. We had a nice format. So he was pretty good. Although we did have a bunch of idiots at the show in Glasgow who were really loud. And then we kept trying to tell them to shut up and they wouldn't. And I've never had this before. I've had people hover before, but these guys walked backstage and came into the dressing room to try and get a selfie with JR. And I'm usually a fairly calm person, and I just started shoving them as hard as I could and just shouting, you know, get out. Because these guys had paid for a general admission ticket and then thought, I'll just go backstage to get a photo with JR. And I made very sure they did not get that. And there was no way they were going to get it. So that was a challenge. But apart from that, it was a very busy 3 days.
Did they respect your authority when you wielded it, when you exercised it?
They didn't really have a choice because they were still shouting to JR to try and get a photo as I was shoving one into the other to basically shove them out of the area.
It's not.
Look, I'm not going to come in and steal sweets at your shop. Don't come and steal sweets out of mine.
Exactly.
Apart from that, it was all good. So, it's been a nice week. Sandra and I recorded earlier on this week, and now this is the first time that we're going to be doing a podcast about the AEW and NXT shows. So,
yes.
This will be pretty interesting because we've not really talked long form about both shows on a single podcast, so that is going to be pretty interesting. But I thought before we got into it, we could talk about a couple of news items.
Yes, let's do that.
So obviously the big news that was kind of rumoured is that WWE will be bringing WrestleMania 37 to SoFi Stadium in the suburbs of Los Angeles and Inglewood in 2021. WrestleMania Hollywood. What do you make of them taking the show back to LA? That's the first time they've done it in the stadium setting. And were you a fan of the Hollywood one when they did it back in 2005?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought it was an inspired advertising campaign that they came up with all the like movie, what would you call them, like parodies?
Yeah,
or
the parody trailers.
Yeah. I mean, I think my favourite probably was the Undertaker Dirty Harry one. I know a lot of people like the Basic Instinct one.
You've got to remember, there's also the... I can't remember if it was an outtake, but after Triple H and Ric Flair did Braveheart, there was Ric Flair wooing the donkey. not wooing as in like trying to take the donkey out on a date, but you know, woo at the donkey.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Good job that you cleared that one up, Kenny. We didn't want any trouble concerning that comment.
You don't want the dirt sheets picking up on it.
Exactly. So yeah, there's the Braveheart one as well. What was another good one? Batista as Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver.
That was that. That was great.
That was a good one. So, you know, they're going to have to go some to top that, because that was, I seem to remember at the time that, I can't remember who it was that was responsible for devising that, but there was, you know, backslapping all round in WWE to the person in question who came up with that campaign. I thought it was great success. The fact that we're still talking about it now, what is this, nearly 15 years on, says it all, doesn't it, really? So, yeah, it was very, very effective. Just really witty and creative, and you know, it was the sort of thing that really got people talking, and got people talking who weren't wrestling fans as well. You know, all tongue-in-cheek stuff, and that's the way wrestling should be at times. Obviously, not always, but at times. And I think with an advertising campaign for a major pay-per-view, then the tongue-in-cheek stuff works really well. And lots of people, you know, like the fact that wrestling's prepared to send itself up a little bit. And I'm sure that they're going to do something, not the same, but something along the lines of something to do with film, or it'll have a filmic theme in some way to promote the show. I mean, it would be ideal, I guess, if they were to, say, induct Dwayne Johnson and John Cena next year in the Hall of Fame, wouldn't it? With them both being now big players in Hollywood.
Makes sense.
That would be very fitting, I feel.
Or it could be the year where they give John Cena his 17th title reign. Either or, Finn. Either or.
Let's just not talk about that. You know, I've been considering, you know, I've been thinking to myself this week, he's going to ask me about the news that John Cena is returning to SmackDown on the 28th.
I'm a journalist. That's my job. I've got to ask you what you think about the big stories.
Well, I just can't find the words, really.
Well, the other thing that's strange is I feel that there is this thing, you know, all joking aside, is that if Cena's coming back and doing something, right? If he was coming back on Raw, I can almost kind of fantasy book a couple of things. But the SmackDown roster is so kind of, you know, bare that I just can't imagine that there's anything on SmackDown that he would be doing, unless they just are trying to put him on SmackDown to pop a number. But WrestleVotes had said that apparently he has chosen what he would like to do creatively for WrestleMania. So I guess whatever he's doing, you know, it is on him. If it's good, he reaps the credit. If it's bad, he gets the shit for it. So, but he's coming back in 2 weeks. Don't worry, Finn. He's not going to be on tomorrow night's Valentine's Day edition, because that of you watching John Cena on Valentine's Day, the irony runneth over.
It does indeed, yes, it does. But you're right, him returning the night after that's the day after the Super Showdown event, isn't it?
It is, yeah. They're in Saudi Arabia on the 27th, and then this is the show on the 28th.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, when you think about it, it's like, well, are they going to be back from Saudi for that? I think, can they do it in time?
I think they can do it if they leave right after the show. But I imagine there's not going to be everybody from the show on the Saudi Arabia event.
Yeah, I mean, that's going above and beyond the call of duty. I mean, I know WWE wrestlers are expected to work hard, but I mean, that would be pretty knackering, wouldn't it, to do the Super Showdown event and then have to wrestle on SmackDown the following night. But I imagine, yeah, an appearance, but doing long matches. I mean, I guess some of these people are pretty much superhuman, so I guess they probably could do it. But it's still, that's quite an ask, isn't it, from WWE? But you're right, on SmackDown, who is there for John Cena to wrestle? And the immediate assumption is maybe he'll do something with The Fiend. I mean, if he's doing something in terms of having a match, you would think it's going to be one of the big stars, and there's not that many stars on SmackDown, so it's probably going to be The Fiend. But then everyone's saying The Fiend's going to defend against Roman Reigns, so that's probably not going to happen. But I think more likely Cena's not going to wrestle because of all the reasons that would be obvious. And Dwayne Johnson's, the problems Dwayne Johnson had after his match with Cena, in which he was injured, and that delayed shooting on a forthcoming movie, and he wasn't available for a film premiere for the Michael Bay movie. Was it Pain and Gain, was it?
Pain and Gain. Pain and Gain, yeah.
That's it, yeah. And Michael Bay, we talked about this before, Michael Bay publicly went out and said, listen, Dwayne Johnson just needs to grow up. He's not a wrestler anymore. He's now an actor. He needs to stick to acting and he needs to stop wrestling because this is jeopardizing huge movie productions and potential box office grosses because he's not available to do the things he needs to do for his full-time job. And I would think, given where Cena is and what's about to come out, I don't know whether he's going to want to send the message to Hollywood that he's willing to jeopardize his health and potential future movie projects just to get back in the ring one more time. So I'm leaning towards him not wrestling just because I think he needs to. I think he'll have been told not to wrestle because he needs to send the right message to the people that he's working with full time now. And if he's going back, it would just be a nostalgia thing where he's not going to take any chances. That's my theory. Could be wrong, but that's my theory. What do you think, Kenny?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not The Fiend, I mean, maybe you could do a story with Daniel Bryan because he's one of the only people that isn't doing anything at WrestleMania yet of any substance. But once you get out of the kind of Roman Bryan Fiend territory, I just can't think of anybody else who either warrants a big match with Cena or somebody who he would see that he wants to work with. So, but I think it's a good hook for the 28th because you want to see who he's going to be facing. You want to see what he's going to be doing. So we shall see. The other big news was that New Japan have announced they're going to be running they're going to be running Madison Square Garden on August 22nd, the night before SummerSlam, head-to-head with the NXT TakeOver in Boston. They're going for it as on their own. You know, AEW, their contracts will not allow Jon Moxley or Chris Jericho to participate at the events. So it is going to be a pure New Japan crew. They're heavily promoting this Wrestle Dynasty idea of the idea of almost like a Wrestle Kingdom in America, and that's going to be the sell. What do you think the chances are of selling out and of it being a big success? The last time, obviously, that they had sold out the event well before the Elite left, well before everything changed. So it's a ballsy move for them. What do you think?
It is a gutsy move. This is, they're really putting, you know, the heads on the chopping blocks here and just saying, yeah, this is who we are. We believe we're big enough to play this venue and if not fill it, at least nearly fill it, or at least draw a respectable attendance. I mean, if they can only pull 5,000 people into MSG, that there is going to be a bit of a, I mean, it's not going to be good for their international reputation, especially now that they generally tell the truth about their attendances. I mean, many times previously, New Japan has grossly exaggerated its live attendance figures for face-saving purposes. I hope they don't have to bring that tactic back. It does seem courageous, given the amount of things that are going on at that time. And as you say, we talked about this previously, hadn't we? That when that original MSG show was announced, Cody and Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, they were all still attached to New Japan and Ring of Honor. And the assumption was that they would be there. So, you know, and then you actually look at the Ring of Honor New Japan supercard that they ran at MSG last year. I mean, it was not well received at all, was it, Kenny? I mean, it just wasn't. I mean, it looks really second rate, and it was no real surprise that New Japan and Ring of Honor, that relationship would disintegrate after that show. So it's very much a, you know, statement of intent that, you know, we are big enough, or we believe we're big enough now to be able to do this on our own. I mean, I've no idea whether they're going to be able to fill that venue. I think if they did have access to Jon Moxley and Chris Jericho, that would be a huge selling point. And I think they would be in business, and there would be a lot more people who would have a lot more faith in them filling the place had they at Exeter, those two who would have then been in top matches. So I don't know, we'll see what happens.
It's going to be a big test to see if, you know, if the New Japan audience in America, I mean, because I think when they did the tour last September, they were drawing about 4,000, 4,500 people per night. You know, say if you say that New York is automatically a better market and that gets them another 3,000-4,000 people and they get up to 8. I mean, although 8,000 people is a great number, not to dispute that, but I think that with Madison Square Garden, like, you almost have to do 16,000-17,000 to break even to do one of those shows. Like, it's you either need to sell out. I mean, I think the first time they did $1 million gate, which was great, but you need to be sort of hitting that to make it worthwhile. So I don't know enough to know whether, and I don't think anybody really knows the answer to the question, which is why it's kind of an interesting prospect, because before was such a different situation to what it is now. And the question is going to be now, are you going to get 20,000 people who want hard-hitting, strong-style wrestling from, you know, these wrestlers who are kind of, not, underground's not the word, but they're not mainstream names.
No.
It's the equivalent if you love indie movies or something, and there's like an indie actor that you love, like, you know, the layman in the street movie goer might not know who they are, but you would because you watch all the independent flicks, you know, before the Sundance Film Festival or whatever. So I think that that's going to be the trick for them. And I mean, because I know that a lot of people said, oh, there's never going to be a partnership with AEW and New Japan. I think if this show's not doing well, you could see them fastly deciding that a partnership could be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think New Japan, there's an arrogance there that we don't need AEW. I'm sure
there's hurt feelings, I'm guessing, from the
with
everybody leaving.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, that's, it seems like a long time ago now, but really, we're only going back 13 months, aren't we, since those guys left?
Yeah.
So, there was a lot of discontent there in New Japan, a lot of resentment that these guys that they had helped make into stars, or at least given the platform to become bigger stars than they were, would then leave to set up a new company. So you can understand why there would be, you know, some frost there between them. But maybe it would be a good thing in the long run if New Japan can't draw like a five-figure crowd in MSG, because then they'll have to reach out to AEW, which I think would be to the benefit of both companies long term. I think that one thing that also needs to be mentioned, Kenny, is that this isn't the first time. Obviously, New Japan, I know this was in conjunction with Ring of Honor, but New Japan has been there before. So it's not the first time they've been there. And I think whenever a company plays MSG for the first time, there's a lot of people who say, yes, I've got to be there because it's the first time and I've got to be there for that show. And okay, you could say, well, this is the first sort of exclusive, you know, New Japan branded show there, but most of the talent or many of the stars have already been there, so it doesn't have that going for it either. But I think with it being the New York market and there's such a massive catchment area of wrestling fans, I think it's going to do well. I think it'll do, I think it'll do sort of pretty close to 10,000, if not more. And I think if they can get more than 10,000, I think they'll consider that a success. And I don't know whether they're really doing this to make money. I think they're doing this to enhance their status on the world stage. I mean, this is, you could say this is almost like a vanity project. You know, we've all done those, you know, an ego thing to prove that they single-handedly can play that venue and draw a hefty crowd. And if they can, then good on them. I mean, because that will be something that's going to really elevate New Japan's status in on the worldwide wrestling stage, I would have thought. What do you think, Kenny?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, if they do manage to pull in 10,000 people, that is a success in terms of, you know, the fact they've been able to go to Madison Square Garden and do that. But I think if they're not pulling that figure in, then if they want to make it big in the States, they're probably going to have to look at that AEW relationship. And yeah, I think that's going to be a hard pill to swallow for them. But in saying that, we did see at Wrestle Kingdom that, you know, in the Jericho match, if he lost, then he would have to defend the AEW championship. Was it Tanahashi, I think it was?
Yes.
Yeah. So, that was put through. So that's maybe a starting point. But Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where we are in a few months' time, once tickets have gone on sale, and see where it goes. So,
I mean, if the show's suddenly cancelled, then we'll know that they weren't doing very well on the ticket front. Yeah, if the show suddenly disappears.
I did want to ask you before we talk about AEW and NXT. We did see Randy Orton in a segment on Raw with Matt Hardy, where Matt Hardy was kind of written off TV. And, you know, Matt Hardy was bringing up all the previous stuff with Edge and Lita and all that, and talking about how, you know, when Edge retired, all his hate for him went away, and he just felt so bad that he couldn't go out on his own terms. And then he finally got the chance to come back, and Orton had to ruin it for him. How could he? And then Orton basically took out Hardy with a concerto and kind of wrote him off. What did you think of it as a kind of way to write off Matt Hardy? Was it a good way to use him on his way out?
And yes. Simply put, yes, it was, Kenny. It was. I thought it was about the only time he's been relevant in, I don't know, when was the last time he was relevant? When he was tag team champion with Bray Wyatt. And that was a bit of a shambles, wasn't it? Losing to the B team, for Christ's sake. So, I mean, I think that's the first time that Matt Hardy's done anything that mattered in 2 years. Probably.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing he did that really mattered before that. Well, I mean, he did manage to get his deletion match main event in Raw a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Which was a big thing, given that, you know, it didn't seem like that was ever going to happen. But yeah, since the Bray Wyatt, and even it seems like they've always kind of been half pregnant with him when he's come back. You know, they'll give him something, but they don't really want to push him too hard.
Yeah.
And I assume he's gone. I don't know, but you know. Reading between the lines, if you look at what happened on Raw, 2 + 2 usually equals 4.
Yes, absolutely. No, I thought it was the perfect way for him to bow out, because he was part of a storyline that's going to be one of the big matches at WrestleMania. I mean, WWE is doing an excellent job with his storyline. Just keeping it simmering, you know, not rushing it. Last thing we want is Edge coming back too soon before they make their match official at WrestleMania. And by coming up with devices like this, it's really keeping this storyline alive without burning it out, or without really using up any of its value. I mean, this is just almost like going off on a tangent here, isn't it? It was almost like, let's go off on this tangent just to fill time this week. We'll talk about it, but we're not really getting ourselves into this position where we've got to try and keep Edge and Randy Orton, this issue, hot. So by involving other players, that preserved the central feud, you know, the main thrust of it, for late March, early April, which is when it needs to peak. You know, we've seen this many times over the years where WrestleMania feuds have actually peaked 2 or 3 weeks before the show. We've seen that many times, haven't we, Kenny?
Lots of times the match is basically made by the beginning of February, and then you've got 7 weeks where you kind of have to, you know, just basically cut the same promo.
Yeah. So I mean,
I think a good example of a recent storyline that they actually added threads to week after week after week was the Ronda Rousey mixed tag that he did a couple of years ago, where it was, you know, she was coming in, they had the stuff with her against Triple H and Stephanie, then we had Angle joining, and there was a lot of different kind of twists and turns that took you through February and March, and it meant that you weren't kind of sick of it. You know, you were, someone was, I think it was the February pay-per-view of that year that they had like Ronda put Triple H through a table when they were trying to sign her, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah. These are the kind of stories that you want. You, like, we all know where it's going to go, but just, like, you know, take us on a fun ride to get there.
That's right, and surprise us along the way, you know, and keep us entertained, and keep increasing the heat, you know, and just keep turning the heat up, just ever so gradually each week. I mean, they don't need to announce that this match is happening for another 4 weeks, really. I mean, until mid-March. And then maybe you'll have the contract signing and one final sort of square off between them. You know, maybe they'll come up with something where they're not allowed to lay hands on each other in the last 2 weeks before, or something like that. I don't know. But I don't. Once they start beating each other up and doing the pull apart brawls, that to me is when you're entering dangerous territory, because you're threatening to do something on Raw that might be better than what will take place at WrestleMania. And that then inevitably leads to disappointment. But I thought Matt Hardy did a really good job there. He seemed very sincere in everything he said. And I think he was as well, because, I mean, obviously he was furious about what went down in 2005, you know, with the whole love triangle with Matt, and he was with Lita at the time. And then he found out that Lita was having an affair, Amy was having an affair with Adam, and that was all genuine. And obviously Matt got fired as well by WWE as a result of going public about that affair. It was the talk of the industry for weeks. And then Matt comes back, and then they have the feud, and Edge wins the feud, and Matt's kind of buried for a few years. And, you know, then lots of things happen in his professional and personal life that are very problematic. Reinvents himself, you know, on the independent circuit, comes up with the Broken Matt gimmick, which was such a sensation that WWE ended up signing him in early 2017, and they have the big comeback and WrestleMania, and it's huge. And, you know, really his whole WWE run didn't measure up to a lot of people's expectations. I always thought there was going to be a lot of problems there, because I didn't think that Vince would really get the Broken gimmick and would be reluctant to use it on TV, which is exactly what happened. And I think the Woken version of the character was a heavily diluted version of the TNA Impact version, Impact Wrestling version. But seeing him on Raw this week and just going out there and really putting Edge over and just really, I think, finding real emotion for his promo and then sacrificing himself in the storyline in order to further this feud between Randy Orton and Edge. I mean, I just thought that was the perfect way for him to make his exit from WWE. You know, he went along on Monday in a way selflessly, in fact, in every way selflessly. He was all about putting other people over and putting guys over who were going to have a big match at WrestleMania. So I think he deserves a huge round of applause for what he did on Monday. And I hope that was his final appearance for WWE, because I think, to me, in many ways, that would be that's the perfect way for him to take his leave.
You're never going to get a better one than that from the current climate. Okay, so we're going to talk about NXT and AEW. Let's start with NXT. It was the go-home show for TakeOver Portland. Before we get into the minutiae of it, what did you think of this week's episode of NXT and the build for Portland?
I thought the previous weeks was better, particularly the appearance from Charlotte. I thought that was a really good angle on the February 5th NXT. So I didn't think it was as good as the previous weeks. Kind of almost feels like they've, just like we were just talking about a moment ago, where some of the storylines had peaked the week before. But at the same time, you think, well, what did they really do with Johnny Gargano and Finn Balor? They didn't really do anything on this week's show, did they? Johnny Gargano was in a match against Cameron Grimes, which was a terrific match. But we didn't really get anything between Gargano and Finn Balor.
No, they did the split screen interview last week, but nothing this week. I made the mistake, I think, of watching the AEW show first and then watching NXT, and I felt like the AEW show had a lot more urgency to it, and a lot more just kind of, they were, it felt like there was big stuff happening. Now, NXT did have one of my favourite things of the week with Matt Riddle and Pete Dunne and their vignettes, adding some much-needed humour to NXT that's kind of been gone for a while. But I think that NXT is a great television show for in-ring wrestling, but this show felt more like everybody who's in a match at TakeOver hears them facing somebody you know they're going to beat before they get to Sunday. So it wasn't that it was bad, but it felt like if I missed this episode, there wasn't a lot that I had to see before Portland.
No, I would agree. It did feel quite predictable, didn't it? Most of the matches were, and you knew what was going to happen before it occurred. And sometimes that's not such a bad thing. But I mean, I think if you're trying to draw a rating head to head with another promotion on another channel, you do need to do better than that. Maybe they sort of felt, well, you know what? We've done enough already to promote Portland, TakeOver Portland. And they have. And the lineup really is killer, isn't it? I mean, what a lineup.
It could be the best TakeOver of all time. It's that good.
Yeah, and I just feel like they think, well, you know what? We're probably not going to beat Dynamite in the viewing figures. Does it really matter? Well, no, it doesn't. We've done a tremendous job already promoting this event. You know, and this is after they just did the World's Collide event as well, just recently. That was the night before Royal Rumble, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, I mean, I think they've done a really good job on the Portland TakeOver event. And yeah, maybe they just got a little bit lazy. Maybe they just thought, you know what, we've done enough. We can take our foot off the accelerator pedal.
Well, listen, we're not going to go through, obviously, every angle and match from both shows, but we'll go through the big stuff. So, on NXT, we start off with Roderick Strong taking on Bronson Reed, and Roderick Strong gets the win. He actually uses some really great power on Bronson Reed, which was fantastic to watch. But the big story was Velveteen Dream post-match on the big screen, showing Roderick Strong's family and saying that if anything ever happened to Roderick Strong and he couldn't make it home, someone will be available to fulfill Marina's dreams. And he showed on his tights that he had Marina and their son's faces on it. And Roderick Strong ran to the back. So that is going to be setting up Velveteen Dream and Roderick Strong next week on TV. What did you make of the angle, the match, and the kind of presentation of Strong and Roderick Dream? Strong and Velveteen Dream.
Yeah, really good. I mean, obviously, you and I didn't talk about this because we've never covered NXT in depth before, but you would have discussed this on last week's podcast. Velveteen Dream returned at the end of the February 5th NXT, which to me was a huge bonus at the end of the show. I mean, I thought, wow, you know, what a blockbuster show it was. And then Dream came out at the end, and you're like, wow, what a way to end the program. So it was a really good follow-on from that. We should also mention as well that Bronson Reed had been attacked by Undisputed Era the previous week and beaten down. So this match was a follow-up from that. So that all made sense. Same applied with Adam Cole and Kushida in the main event of the program. Kushida had been beaten up by the Undisputed Era as well on the February 5th NXT. So, yeah, I don't think there was really ever any doubt who was going to win this match between Reed and Strong. But it was the journey, wasn't it, that we were watching this for? You know, Not the destiny. And the destination really was not the pinfall. It was the post-match with Dream turning up on the big screen. And as you see, he's there wearing the ravishing Rick Rude tights, you know, with a picture of Marina and the son on there. And he showed a picture as well of Strong, Marina and their son. And Roderick Strong's in the ring. He's going ballistic. You know, he's seething. He's raging. And Velveteen Dream, you know, because obviously he was the one who, in the storyline, was sidelined by Undisputed Era. So we're on his side, aren't we, Kenny? You know, morally, we're on his side. Even though it seems like he's crossed the line here, involving another man's family in a storyline, it was Undisputed Era who had beaten him up in the storyline and sidelined him since, I think, was it October? I think it was mid-October.
Yeah,
mid-October. So he's been out best part of 4 months, which, as far as we're concerned, is as a result of the Undisputed Era's actions. So Roderick Strong, you know, this is part of his comeuppance. You know, he deserves this. You know, we're rooting for the Dream to stick it to Roderick Strong. You know, I'm not going to mention anything about Marina and use that phrase in connection with Dream and Marina, because that would be improper, Kenny, wouldn't it? That would be beneath me.
You're too much of a gentleman. But you know, it is this weird thing where it's kind of, you know, in theory, the babyface should be Roderick Strong, because what Dream's doing is a heel move. But it's kind of like, you know, when Moxley took out Santana's eye, you know, he did that in retaliation. And Velveteen Dream was doing this in retaliation. So
yeah.
I think it's, you know, we're very far removed from just like traditional babyface and heel stuff. So I think it's okay to mix it up now and then. And also Velveteen Dream, if he just became this kind of valiant babyface, that would kind of take away a lot of what people love about him. Like, yeah, people love that he's a bit of a shit starter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is something that everyone who's in a position of power in NXT, and probably Dream himself, I'm sure he must be smart enough by now to be able to see what can happen to talent when they go to the main roster. I mean, this is the fear, isn't it? Is that if he is called up after WrestleMania, and it sort of feels like maybe it would be his time to be called up after WrestleMania, if they're still doing that, if they still do the big call-ups after WrestleMania each year, he's got to be concerned, you know, will the main roster creative team look after me? Will they book me with as much care and attention as the NXT team have? So that's going to be a worry for him, because he's in a really good spot right now in NXT. But I mean, you've got to imagine that long term they see him as a main roster player, because he's got more potential to be a, you know, mainstream star if he's wrestling on Raw or SmackDown. And let's face it, Raw, well, actually SmackDown more than Raw, the main roster need guys like Velveteen Dream. And there's so many people in the developmental territory. There's so many people at the Performance Center who are itching, waiting for a spot to wrestle on TV, that in many ways Dream needs to move up to the main roster to create a, you know, an opening for a newcomer to, you know, enter the frame and then develop into a star and theoretically move up to the main roster in 18 months or 2 years' time. So you need that sort of constant sort of movement of talent, don't you? That's what the machine's supposed to do. NXT is supposed to create these stars who then go on to be bigger stars on Raw or SmackDown. But anyway, getting back to what we were talking about, yeah, really good performance from Dream. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to the match between Dream and Strong on NXT next week.
We also on the show got Dakota Kai beating Candice LeRae in a match. After the match, we ended up seeing Tegan Nox run out, and they had a brawl. And, you know, it's weird because I remember at TakeOver War Games just being so into the Dakota Kai heel turn and all that kind of stuff. And I felt when we finished this, I mean, the match was decent, but when we finished the match and the post-match angle with Tegan Nox, I didn't walk away from it going, I can't wait for these two to get in a street fight and fight. And I don't know why, but I think on Sunday they'll do a great job, but I'm just kind of surprised by how kind of underwhelmed I am by this match. Because I thought the more I see stuff with them, I'd get more and more invested.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose you've got to remember, we are 3 months removed, aren't we, from Survivor Series weekend, which was when that TakeOver event took place. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they haven't managed to keep the heat up, have they? You know, it's like somebody switched the heating off in the interim. And they're now desperately trying to warm this feud up again.
Listen, Finn, if MD knows about heating not working, it's me. Mine hasn't worked since fucking November.
Exactly.
But then, you know, the other week Tegan Nox beat Dakota Kai in 3 minutes, and I said to Sondra, I was like, you know, maybe they're doing something to make that make sense. And I feel like that's kind of cooled it down a little bit as well, because the fact that she beat her in 3 minutes kind of goes, well, why would you then want to watch it in a street fight?
Exactly. And Dakota Kai, I mean, Candice LeRae, I mean, she's a real talent, but in this position on this show, she was there to shine Dakota Kai for the big match at a TakeOver event. And it was just such a... Dakota Kai almost had to score a fluke pin to beat her. So it didn't seem like she was superior to Candice. And on this night, she absolutely should have seemed like she was much better than Candice, and that she could win, she could defeat her handily in order to have a chance of settling the score with Tegan Nox in the street fight at TakeOver. So yeah, the whole arrangement and presentation of this is perplexing. And for NXT, which usually gets these simple things right, I can't really explain it. And I think they're going to be swimming upstream in this match at TakeOver, because I think they will get people into it, but I think they're going to have to work really hard and probably do a lot of silly things, a lot of stunts, and do things that I think it's going to be a big effort for them to draw the crowd into it, because the feud has not been preserved or well maintained in the interim between, you know, Dakota Kai turning heel and us having this big stipulation match at this next TakeOver.
We also had on the show a match to determine the number one contendership for the NXT Cruiserweight title. It was Lio Rush and Angel Garza. They had a 7-minute match with Lio Rush getting the win. Jordan Devlin would end up coming out post-match, kind of confronting Rush, saying that, you know, you don't bet against the ace. It was a really good match. I don't really know how much I'm that bothered about Lio Rush as a cruiserweight contender, but I thought the wrestling was very good.
Yeah, they'd had a match, hadn't they? It was a match in which Angel Garza captured the Cruiserweight title, wasn't it? And that was tremendous. Remember that match that they had?
Yeah, they had a good match.
I mean, this wasn't quite as good as that. I mean, it was a little bit shorter. But I mean, again, it was, I mean, these two guys worked together so well, so smooth. You know, I'm really pleased that Leo Rush has managed to sort of reinvent himself and get away from the main roster and that whole thing with Lashley that he was involved with. I think he always had a limited shelf life, and I think he's in a much better position right now in NXT, really showing what he's got. He's the booking him in long matches, and I just think this is a much better spot for him. It was the result was a surprise. This was probably the only result of the night that was surprising, because Angel Garza had mentioned the previous week that he wanted his title back, and I did think that Angel, you know, in a continuation of that, I did think that Angel would defeat Leo Rush here, and he didn't do. So that was quite an interesting development. The fact that Angel, who, you know, coming off his Raw, you know, star enhancing stuff with Rey Mysterio, I felt like this was going to be Angel's time. You know, maybe their long term plan is to move him over into Raw full time, and it makes sense for Leo to go over here. But yeah, it was a really good match. Not as good as the previous match, but it was a good match.
I do hope that the Angel Garza does go up to Raw, because I think he's got a lot more to offer, and I think that he would. I think him and Andrade kind of in a little stable with Zelina,
yeah,
could be just a good hook. So I hope they go that route.
Definitely.
I also want to give big props to. I've not been hugely into the feud with Keith Lee and Dominik Dijakovic, but I thought the Mark Henry video package with him promoting it was excellent.
Yeah, that was well done. I mean, it's a babyface versus babyface thing, isn't it, with Dijakovic and Keith Lee, and they're never as appealing. And I'm not. I'm kind of surprised that the third person hasn't been added to the mix here, because it almost feels like you need a heel just to really heat this thing up. But it was something different to promote this match. I think it's going to be a good match, and I think people will be into it on the night because Keith Lee is so over. He's a guy who can really do no wrong at the moment. One imagines that Lee's going to retain the title. Hopefully, Dijakovic will have a good night as well. I don't think as a babyface he's as effective as he was as a heel, and I'm not quite sure where he goes after he loses to Keith Lee, because I can't see Keith Lee losing the title already. So I'm not quite sure where he goes after that, but it'll be a good match, I'm sure.
And then we also got Bianca Belair got a win over Santana Garrett, and then yes. Rhea Ripley came out to sort of confront, and she cut off Bianca Belair. Rhea said she's not looking past Bianca, she's looking right at her, and then Sunday she's gonna go right through her, and then they start fighting. And Bianca Belair gets the better of her, plants her with her finish to sort of stand tall. So, I mean, they're doing the typical kind of the heel gets the beatdown in the babyface before the match. You know, she's in this weird spot, Bianca, where we all kind of know it's Rhea and Charlotte at WrestleMania. So she's the kind of background player. But I think that she obviously needed to get a beatdown here, I think, so that you could pose it as some sort of threat for Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to plant the seeds of doubt over who's going over, and it does seem fairly obvious that it's going to be Rhea Ripley, even though, I mean, I think it would be quite something if Charlotte were to turn up after the match and to make the announcement to Rhea, who's presumably going to retain at the TakeOver event. But I would like to point out that I think Belair is kind of babyface. You know, she was very much, I think, the heel at Royal Rumble. But fans have definitely been cheering her, especially in her interaction with Charlotte. And I think a lot of people are siding with Bianca because when she's saying everyone, you know, Rhea Ripley and Charlotte, they're looking past me, you know, they're giving me no respect, you know, what about me type of thing. I think a lot of fans are looking at her, especially after a performance at Royal Rumble, and they're saying, you know, she is a force to be reckoned with here. Let's not treat her as an afterthought. Let's not treat her as a stepping stone. She could conceivably become NXT Women's Champion. So I think a lot of fans are siding with her. I think that she's really gone up in fans' estimations, especially since Royal Rumble. So I think she's really handled herself very well in these promo segments as Bianca. I thought she did really well on the February 5th NXT with Charlotte and Rhea. I thought, you know, her body language there was really good and her reactions felt genuine. You could say, well, she's slightly over the top. Hell, that's pro wrestling for you. And she does things that other people don't do. So she's really somebody who's impressed me this year as Bianca Belair. And I'm hoping she has a really good night at TakeOver. I don't think she's going to win, but I hope she has like a really good match. And, you know, based on the progress she's made this year, I can see her as NXT Women's Champion in future. What do you think, Kenny?
Yeah, she's. I think they could steal the show on Sunday. Bianca Belair is, you know, great. I loved her performance in the Royal Rumble. I think that she's, you know, she should be the future, one of the future top babyfaces in WWE because she's just so cool. She's got a lot going for her. And yeah, I think her and Rio have a great match on Sunday. The main event of the show, we saw Adam Cole taking on Kushida in a non-title match. I think it would be virtually impossible for these two to have a bad match because Kushida's so good in the rings, as is Adam Cole. Obviously, Cole got the win in the end, but not like a short squash or anything. Kushida was given a lot of offense and it went about 13 minutes. So there was a lot going in and, you know, he got to his hoverboard lock and all these different things. So like it was good. And then obviously Ciampa came out at the end and they faced off and Ciampa says he's taking his life back and Cole says over my dead body you do. So I thought it was a good main event. I think the main event was good, but I think if you're sitting watching, you're going, what channel am I going to watch? I don't think you're going to stick around for Cole versus Kushida because I just don't think there's no question in you that Kushida's going to even have a chance to win.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I thought it was really funny when Kushida started doing the Kawada kicks and Ranallo on commentary started having this massive mark out moment. It was just hilarious. And like Ranallo basically never blows it on commentary and he kind of blew it on commentary and he sort of tripped over his words and Beth Phoenix and Nigel McGuinness cracked up. You know, like that Ronaldo got so giddy, probably thinking about, you know, Kawada's matches with Mazawa and Kobashi and Atawe and all those guys. And like that really did crack me up. I rewound that and watched that again. Very funny. And I thought it was good as well that, you know, Ciampa confronted Cole after the match, that they didn't start trading blows because we'd had loads of backstage angles and fights. We'd had that big brawl on the February 5th. NXT that then led to the six-man match in the main event. So I thought it was refreshing that they didn't resort to violence and that it was just words and the camera moved in close so it could hear everything that they were saying. And yeah, I thought it was, I do know what you mean. It was not, in a way, because either in a way, Adam Cole and Kushida is a match that lacks the wow factor. Because you know Kushida's not going to win. So it kind of does lack the wow factor. But they did counterbalance that by having a really good match. And then I think the Ciampa appearance at the end was a, you know, very fitting way to end the show. And just by doing something different as well, rather than having another brawl. We didn't need to see that. Save that for TakeOver. I think we also need to mention as well the Pete Dunne and Matt Riddle japes.
Finn, I was saving that for last. Because that was my favourite part of the show. I've said how much I hate the Dusty Rhodes Tag Classic, and finally they seem to have done something with it. They do these vignettes of them trying to get to Portland with the trophy. They're driving and they get pulled over because neither of them have got a license. They're on this weird duck boat thing in the middle of the ocean. And then there's a private jet at the end, and basically Matt Riddle makes it like he's... You know, he's got it, and it's for them. Pete doesn't buy it, but then Riddle, like, shoves him into the hold because it's Triple H's plane because he comes out. This was great, and I hope that these two win the titles on Sunday and have a reign because this is going to get Pete Dunne over. Pete Dunne being the straight man to Matt Riddle being the kind of goofy, wacky stoner. It's just they've stumbled onto something really great. A lot of humor's not been involved in NXT recently, and... this was a welcome addition. This was like the highlight of the show for me by a mile.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this team. I mean, they did some good promo work in the run-up to the final of the Dusty Classic. I know when they went head-to-head with the Grizzled Young Veterans, there was some good banter there. And it's like the oddest of odd couples, isn't it, these two, with Pete Dunne there as the straight man and Matt Riddle's there like... hamming it up and sending himself up and, you know, doing this Rob Van Dam gimmick, you know, and anyone who knows his history in UFC knows that, you know, there is a element of truth to the way that Matt Riddle is behaving on TV. You know, he has, let's face it, he has a track record, a checkered track record in that area, doesn't he, Kenny?
He does.
Yeah,
yes, so, he does.
And it's funny, you know, they're there in the car and Pete Dunne doesn't have a driving license and the car gets impounded. So they have to, they're standing on the roadside, them two and the big Dusty Rhodes classic trophy, you know, what we're going to do next. And Matt Riddle's like, well, you should know not to drive without a license, Pete. And Pete says, well, you don't have one either. And Matt said, well, I thought more of you. You've let me down. You know, that he was thinking that Pete would be the sensible one of the two. So I thought that was really funny. And weren't they on like a, wasn't it like a swan they were on, Kenny? Like a pedal swan.
They were on a big swan pedaling boat.
Yeah, one of those pedaling boats. And I think they were on like some small pond or mini sort of man-made lake somewhere. And then it's like, and then we had like to be continued. And then, you know, they're just there. Matt Riddle saying, well, I'm on this swan here to, you know, this is my tranquil time. You know, this is where I do my best thinking. And then he comes up with this master plan. It says at the end of it, to be concluded. And they're there at the airport and there's a private jet and Pete can't believe it. You know what? This is for us. And then they shove the Dusty Rhodes Classic trophy into the hold. And then those two become stowaways in the hold, in the baggage area of the plane. And we see Triple H climbing aboard the plane and they're on the way to Portland. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And these two, I think, have got tremendous potential. There's so much they can do together. And I'm with you. I really hope they win the title at the event this weekend. Because I think they can do so much with it. And I think these two could be huge stars in this company.
Yeah, I really hope they do it. Because the thing is, at the end, you wanted the plane to belong to either Triple H or Vince. Like, you just wanted it to be something like that, and they did it, so fair play.
And it'll be funny as well, you know, when they get there, and they can say, oh, you know, and they can do some jokes about, you know, there's no bathroom, you know, they can do that, and, like, really uncomfortable. You know, there's all sorts of, you could, there's all sorts of mileage that they can squeeze out of this, they can extract out of this. So I'm really looking forward to the event now, just to see the latest development in the saga of Pete and Matt's trip to Portland.
Make it a network show. Over on TNT, we had AEW Dynamite from Austin, Texas. Before we go into the minutia, what did you make of the show overall?
I enjoyed this week's show. I thought it had a great energy to it. I didn't think there was too many. There's always with Dynamite, it always sags at least a couple of times. But I think the only time it really did here was, I think, was in the main event between Santana and John Moxley. But that had like a real, you know, killer finish afterwards. So, I mean, you know, all sins were forgiven there. I thought there was some really good story advancement. They were doing things with different characters like Dustin Rhodes and Jake Hager. I thought the women's title match was very well done. That was much better than I was expecting. I mean, there was a few things wrong with it, which we'll get to, as there always is. But I mean, yeah, overall, I did enjoy the show. I mean, it does feel like they're gathering momentum in the run-up to a Revolution on February 29th.
Yeah, it does. I would say that I would be amazed if AEW did not win the ratings based on these two shows. I think there just seemed to be more going on that kind of was set up as opposed to things being just, you know, like we said on with NXT, the wrestling was great, but a lot of it was kind of, you know, you don't think that Bronson Reed's going to beat Roderick Strong. You don't think that Cameron Grimes is going to beat Johnny Gargano. You don't think that, Kushida's going to be Adam Cole. So I can see that if you're channel surfing, you might want to see what else is going on. We open the show with SCU against Kenny Omega and Hangman Page for the AEW Tag Team titles, the rematch. You know, during the match, SCU were not playing fair at certain points, Finn. They were in it to win it. But in the end, Omega and Page kind of stepped up to them and were able to get the win when they did the buckshot lariat V-trigger combo on Kazarian and got the 1-2-3. Page immediately takes beer and leaves to the crowd. But what did you make of the opening tag match?
I mean, I did quite like it. I mean, I thought it was interesting, and this is something like 6 months ago, you would never have believed this, that this match, Kenny Omega was in there as Hangman Page's setup man. I mean, I know you would never imagine this, Kenny,
never in a million
6 months
years.
Ago. You know, you're like, well, hold on a minute. Kenny Omega is partly booking this as well. So, I mean, that did, you know, each time that happens, and we've seen quite a lot of that with Omega being subordinate to Page, it kind of should be the other way around. But that's what, in a way, makes it more interesting. So Page got the hot tag, fans really responded to him. They like this guy, even though he's acting like a bit of a knob at times. He was the most popular person in this match. Would you agree with that, Kenny?
Yeah, he 100% was. I assume that initially when they were doing the whole Page Omega dissension that they were going to have it be, you know, that Page would go heel. But it's very clear that people love Page. They don't want him to go heel. I think that's probably for the best.
Yeah, and I think you would hope that AEW is going to be smart enough to read these signs and not turn him. And even though it seems like that's the direction they're going in, that could backfire on Omega. It really could. Just a couple of things about this match that were just a bit weird. On the previous week's AEW, Page, he wouldn't allow the Young Bucks to tag in, wouldn't he? It was in the eight man, wasn't it?
It was the eight man tag with them in the Bucks against Butch and the Blue. Yeah, the eight man.
That's right, and the Lucha Brothers as well, wasn't it? So the Young Bucks wanted to tag in Page. It was, you know, he was fatigued. He needed to tag out. Page refused to do so, and then Page ended up doing the job. He ended up losing the match. And then backstage afterwards, the Bucks started yelling at Page, saying to him, "Oh, what are you doing? You know, this is crazy." And they were actually doing that in the ring as well after the loss, saying, "You know, if you do this next Wednesday, you'll lose the title." So that didn't really play into this match. Also, the other thing that I thought was a bit odd, it was Omega that ended up pinning Kazarian in the February 12th tag match. And as the referee's hand came down for the count of three, Kazarian put his hand on the bottom rope. And that it was as if that was not part of the script, because it was never acknowledged.
It kind of felt like the idea should be that Kazarian gets his hand on either right around three, so you can make the argument that it wasn't there. But he had it there, like, well before the three.
Yeah, and the ref was right there, so there's no way the referee couldn't have noticed that. I don't think the announcers mentioned it once, so that was a bit odd.
Yeah, I mean, I can only assume that something went wrong there and they just didn't mention it. Or maybe they are going to mention it, but it's something that you... Because later on in the show, I mean, we should mention, actually, during the match, one of the things that commentary did really well was when Christopher Daniels went back to kind of deal with the Dark Order, the announcers weren't being idiots about it. They were kind of like, you know, that's a bit suspicious that he's leaving during the match. They were kind of calling into question Daniels' allegiance, which is what, as a viewer, you would be thinking of. So that's what you want your commentary team to do. But then at the end of the match, they just didn't know what to do about this hand on the rope thing, so they kind of ignored it, which it was a shame.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kazarian's obviously been doing this for a long time. The announcers have been doing it for a long time. And that was a glaring error by both, really. The announcers should have at least brought it up, you know, just because we could see it. It wasn't as if it was right there on camera. So I thought that was a bit odd. Then afterwards, we ended up having like a big schmoz. Best friends came in, Butcher, Young Bucks, The Blade was there, The Dark Order. So that was a big brawl afterwards, and the Young Bucks basically cleared the ring and then did a big dive out of the ring simultaneously to everyone at ringside. So kind of could have done without the brawl afterwards, if I'm honest with you, Kenny.
So the brawl, obviously, I guess, afterwards was to set up the tag team battle royal for next week, and we're going to see the winners go on to face Kenny Omega and Page at Revolution. But the most interesting part of when the brawl was going on, or when it was about to, was that... Jim Ross made a point of calling the Young Bucks the Bucks of Youth. Did you catch that?
Yes, I did. And I believe Matt Hardy has acknowledged it on Twitter as well.
He has. And I just don't think that JR would have used that specific terminology had he not been instructed to. That felt to me like a little, you know, Easter egg, a little plant, which I'm here for, but, you know, that's what it seemed like to me. What did it seem like to you?
Well, I mean, I don't know with Jim Ross these days.
But I don't think he would have ever known them as the Bucks of Youth, because he never really called that era. So it's not something he would have even been aware of.
Right, yeah. I mean, obviously he wasn't commentating on Impact Wrestling, you know, which was where I think that phrase was first used when he was during his broken phase. And I think, you know, there was a time when it sort of looked like the Young Bucks might make an appearance for Impact. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, you would think that it was planned and that it was something that's going to lead to Matt Hardy's debut in AEW. But at the same time, wouldn't Matt Hardy have made reference to it on Twitter? Because if that was the plan, wouldn't he have just ignored it? Because if he is coming into AEW, Matt Hardy, and I believe he is, you would think that they would want to keep this a surprise, wouldn't you?
But then if he ignores it, does that mean it's more likely? I guess we're never gonna know how they. We'll see. I think it was deliberate. I'm just gonna put it out there. That's my gut feeling. But that was the opener to the show. Then we got a match with Dustin Rhodes and Sammy Guevara, and they have a match. Kind of Dustin Rhodes is looking for revenge after what the Inner Circle did to him last year. He ends up getting the win in his hometown of Austin. Can you imagine that, Finn? A wrestler getting a win in their hometown?
What's the wrestling world coming to, Kenny? Supposed to do the job in your hometown.
Shouldn't you be kissing somebody's ass or something in your hometown? And then Dustin Rhodes gets on the mic after the match and cuts this promo, and he says, "Turn around when I'm talking to you." And Guevara turns around, but it's actually Hager that he wants to. And he said, "You know, are you ever going to do anything here? Or are you just going to collect a paycheck and be Jericho's bitch? You've got a failed career at MMA, failed career here before you've even started. You broke my arm. I want a piece of your ass at Revolution." And he wants the match. And, I mean, Dustin Rhodes is 50 years old, Finn. And he just did not look it here, did not sound it here. He looked, you know, raring to go.
Do I look 50? Do I sound 50, Kenny?
No.
50's the new 30.
Well, and 35's the new 28. I thought Dustin Rhodes here cut a really good promo, and I'm actually into the idea of Dustin Rhodes and Jake Hager. It makes sense that they've waited and had the first match that Hager's going to have be for a reason, from a story. Yes. You know, he broke his arm. I like the story element of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is what Dustin said to Jake Hager. "Are you ever going to step in the ring, or are you just going to keep collecting a paycheck? You're failing at your MMA career. You're failing here before you've even gotten started. So, Jake Hager, listen to me. You broke my arm, and I want a piece of your ass at Revolution." And later on the program, they confirmed that that match will take place at Revolution.
Happy days.
Yeah, so that will be Jake Hager's AEW debut, won't it?
Yeah, well, that'll be his in-ring debut. And I mean, Hager, I think, deserves a lot of credit for some of the stuff that he does. I mean, later on in the show, we'll see at the end, after the beatdown, he plays to the camera so well, and he uses these moments where he's not talking to be, you know, really charismatic. So I think he's doing a really good job. I like when he sort of like rubs it in the babyface's faces. Like once the Moxley thing had happened, he was backstage when Jericho had cut a promo, and as all the Inner Circle are walking away, he's going "Arr!" and doing a pirate noise. So I like that he's just having fun.
Yeah, one thing I like about him is that he's not trying too hard, and it all seems like kind of effortless, and it's very much a less is more approach, which is something you seldom see in pro wrestling, where everyone's attention seeking. And, you know, the fact that he does so little sort of distinguishes him from everyone else. And, you know, he's been doing this for long enough now to know what he's doing. I mean, I really hope it works for him here in AEW, and I would think he's going to beat Dustin at Revolution. He should do. And I really hope it's going to work for him here, because, I mean, you look back on his WWE career And we all expected more from it than he achieved. And there's lots of reasons why it didn't go further than it did. I really hope AEW really goes all the way with him and makes him world champ, but at least gives him a good run and sticks with him. And I'm sure I'm sure he's hoping for that as well. I'm sure you are as well, Kenny.
The thing for me is I just think that this is, you know, obviously Dustin is going to lose. It's not, yeah. Dustin Rhodes is not going to beat Jake Hager, but, you know, you have to give Dustin a win, so give him the win over Sammy to get to Jake Hager. Sammy Guevara is in a good position right now where if Jake Hager lost the match to Dustin Rhodes, that would hurt him as a character. Because yeah. he is this MMA beast, right? But with Sammy Guevara, he's such a kind of sleazy little heel that he can lose a match and then later on still be as over as he was before. And, you know, we saw at another point in the show, we saw Darby Allin do a promo from home where he basically used cue cards to challenge Guevara to match at Revolution. And apparently Darby Allin had initially filmed one of those sort of promos on his own to sort of, you know, help with the show, which I think, you know, you should be doing that. You should be, if you can do things to help your character or help build your profile, why not?
Indeed. I mean, this is something that all wrestlers, and particularly in AEW, which claims to give its performers more freedom of expression and more input into their programs. If you can come up with something that works and, as you say, film it yourself. I mean, the quality of the cameras is so good these days and it's like done at home, so it doesn't have to look world class, but it's good enough. And that almost adds to it that it looks a little bit raw, rough and ready. That kind of adds to it. That adds to the effect that he's trying to achieve. Darby Allin's at home. He's still selling the blow to his throat from the skateboard. So it's good that he's selling that. Challenging Sammy Guevara to a match. Guevara's like this junior member of the Inner Circle. You know, he doesn't matter. He can do jobs for probably next 6 months. Doesn't really matter. It's not going to hurt him. I think the time for him to start winning is when he eventually splits from the Inner Circle and goes it alone. That'll be the time for him to start scoring the wins. But at this moment in time, doesn't really matter if he loses.
So next on the show, we had the women's title match with Rio and Nyla Rose. And like you said, I just did not expect this to be anywhere near as good as it was. It might be my favourite AEW women's match so far. And I just thought the story of Rio trying to overcome Nyla Rose and ultimately not being able to was just a great story.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've never really been taken by Rio previously. I mean, we didn't see her for weeks. I know she was on the February 5th AEW in a backstage segment with Pac. That was when Nyla Rose smashed her into a table, wasn't it? But we hadn't seen Rio for many weeks prior to that. That's correct, isn't it, Kenny?
Yeah, I'm not too sure what her Japanese commitments are. I don't know. Maybe that's what it was. But yeah, she definitely has kind of been sporadically in and out.
So to me, I mean, this is not a rinky-dink company. I mean, this is not like some promotion that can't afford to pay for her to come back from Japan to defend the title. And the fact that she was away for many weeks made me more supportive of the decision for AEW to take the title off her and to give it to Nyla Rose here on the February 12th episode, because that championship should be in circulation. I mean, not every week, but at least every other week, the champion should be making an appearance on Dynamite, in my opinion. And I think most people would agree with that.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I think the other thing is, I like Rio, and I think that she maybe appeals to people, like not us, but maybe I think young girls might, you know, enjoy her because she's someone that's, you know, they could look up to or whatever. But I think that Nyla Rose is going to be a much better vehicle for storylines that you can do with the women and angles that you can do. And I think that she, you know, Nyla had the month's suspension where she ended up going to Japan and sort of, I think she noticeably improved when she came back. And that's a really good sign for just a month. So I think Nyla's champion opens up a lot more possibilities for the viewer than Rio did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a lively atmosphere here. I thought the match was very well put together. Really good pacing. Peaked at the end. Fans with it all the way. I mean, it's just like AEW's women's division has been more missed than hit. I mean, each time they come out, I just expect the worst because I've kind of been conditioned to expect it. So this match here between Rose and Rio, yeah, really good. Absolutely endorse the outcome. And interesting to see, I'm very interested to see what Rose does with the title going forward on future episodes.
I also think it's worth mentioning, I think Sunny Kiss had tweeted it about this, and it's a really cool fact, is that Nyla Rose is, you know, an openly black trans woman who has won the title in Black History Month. And that's a good thing. You know, she doesn't feel like she's there, you know, just to sort of wave the diversity flag, but she's someone who, you know, is a diverse element of the show, and I think she deserves the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, huge contribution in this match. I really think that, I mean, all questions about her competence and her ability to be a big part of this company, I think were answered on this week's episode of Dynamite.
So good for Nyla, and just really good match. If you've not watched it, it's worth checking out. It's, you know, kind of this almost like a video game battle at some points.
I mean, and then it all worked despite the size difference. It was a believable match, wasn't it?
Yeah, because you didn't, in a way, on paper, that should not have worked. You know, like Rio at the end doing a lot of the stuff she did shouldn't maybe work on paper, but in the sort of context of the match, I thought it totally worked.
Yeah.
So we also on the show got Jungle Boy taking on MGF. We had Brandy on commentary. The Nightmare Collective is no more. She's kind of done some stuff on the channels to signify that she did an interview with Wrestling Observer Live where she said that she didn't feel like the gimmick was working. She didn't really like the direction it was going, so she wanted to remove herself from it. So she was on commentary here as Jungle Boy took on MJF. He sends Wardlow to the back, but ultimately Wardlow comes back out and hands the Dynamite Diamond Ring to MJF. He knocks out Jungle Boy with it and then does an awkward version of the Crossroads for the win. And then after
he calls the double cross, doesn't he?
Which he calls the double cross, yeah. And then post match, Wardlow picks up Jungle Boy and sort of tosses him around before Luchasaurus runs in for the save. We're not getting a lot from MGF yet because obviously we're waiting for this Cody match. But I thought that the story here was pretty good. People love Jungle Boy and MGF is a dick, and you know him getting the win and but needing the help of Wardlow is a good story.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the right outcome because MJF is facing Cody in the big match at Revolution that's been so heavily promoted week after week. So I understand why he went over here. I mean, we had that match with Jungle Boy against Jericho back in just before Christmas, wasn't it, in December, where he lasted 10 minutes with Jericho.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I just felt like Jungle Boy was somebody who took great strides in that match and was really enriched by that performance. And so for him to be used here as really as an enhancement player, I thought was disappointing, really. And, you know, there's quite a lot of continuity problems in AEW. And you just mentioned the Brandi Rhodes thing here. So she does an interview with an outside publication, but there's no explanation on Dynamite as to what's happened to the Nightmare Collective. I was expecting some sort of explanation, and there wasn't one. So she's there on commentary as this babyface character. I mean, last time we heard her on commentary, she was blasting everyone. I mean, I know you can say, well, last week she turned up as Brandy, Cody's wife, in the, you know, whipping segment with MJF. So you could kind of say, well, that was when she made the transition from being part of the Nightmare Collective to who she is now. But again, there wasn't really an explanation there.
The only explanation that we got was when on an episode of Dark that Mel and Luther turned on Awesome Kong. But even then, that didn't explain. Brandy had done stuff on her own social media. But I mean, this is, we've said before, the idea of maybe like a control center with Tony Schiavone where we can be updated on this kind of stuff, yeah, I think would really help the flow of the show, especially for some people who maybe don't get a chance to watch every week.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a big commitment. There's a lot of people watching this who won't follow the characters on social media, who won't be going on the news sites, you know, who won't be keeping up with Dark. And something should have been said here. I mean, Brandy, to her credit, she did kind of apologize for her behavior previously. But again, it's like, well, what's happened to this gimmick that you did for several weeks on TV. She's absolutely right. It wasn't working. It was a total disaster. She was terrible in it. So they made the right decision ditching it. But why? We need an explanation. So I just felt that came across as so second rate. And, you know, for Jungle Boy to really lose to MJF here after they'd really built him up in the Jericho feud, I think there was other people that could have been in this position. But, I mean, I suppose there are times when popular baby faces need to do the job. So I mean, maybe I am kind of nitpicking here, and that what Jungle Boy did here was, you know, for the greater good of Revolution and for MJF and for Cody Rhodes, you know, and that matchup. You could almost say he was kind of in the same position here as Matt Hardy was on Raw with Randy Orton.
Yeah.
You know, the difference being that Matt Hardy's like a veteran and he's leaving, so it didn't matter. I mean, MJF does a lot of what I like about MJF. I'm still not convinced that this guy is going to become the person that lots of people think he is. But like, what he does do very well is he does lots of crowd working and stalling. And he does a lot of things that many other wrestlers won't do or are afraid to do, because they feel like they've got to do all these tumbling moves and throw themselves around and no sell everything. And MJF really does a lot more of that, you know, old school 1980s stuff where he's working the crowd. And he's very good at that. He's very effective at that. And the crowd does respond to it. So he does that part of his act, I think he's got nailed down pretty tight. And I think overall this match was decent. You know, I've already made my complaints about it. I don't need to go over them again. And I suppose, you know, in the final analysis, Jungle Boy, much like Matt Hardy on Raw, he needed to be sacrificed to get the big match over. So, I mean, I think, you know, I might have contradicted myself there, but maybe it was worth it.
But I think it's a good argument to make, right? Because what AEW have done so far, they have featured new people like Darby Allin and Jungle Boy, but they haven't really got their big wins yet. So maybe that's the long-form story we're going to be telling. Yeah. I hope it is. You know, that's, I think, especially when a secondary title comes in, I think you could see both of them being firm contenders for it.
Definitely.
And yeah, the fact that we're talking about them and we kind of want to see more from them, I guess, tells us that they've done something to build them to a level where we want to see more from them.
Yeah.
We should mention that Jericho said that next week Jon Moxley is going to have to take on the new hired gun of the Inner Circle, Jeff Cobb, who is apparently a free agent now in pro wrestling, and he is going to be working this angle as of now. Not signed with AEW, but doing this angle. And then the main event of the show, we had Jon Moxley versus Santana, where Moxley did get the win, but a pretty decent match, and then the Inner Circle beat up Moxley after the match with Jeff Cobb included. So it was kind of tied into the show. I did think that the Santana sit-down interview segment with JR was really strong.
Yeah, it seemed very genuine, very sincere, as though, you know, those things really had happened. We should mention this was the eye for an eye match, wasn't it? So.
And they were very clever that the eyes that each man was injured in were the opposite eyes, so that when you saw the graphic, it kind of looked quite nice. They're like, you know, on the far left, the way you look at the screen, it's Moxley's eye, the far right is Santana's. So, yeah, eye for an eye, it's a nice little hook, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that the response to it was pretty flat. I mean, considering the severity of what these two had apparently done to each other, I thought this should have had a lot more heat than it did. I mean, Ortiz and Santana, I don't think have been used anywhere near as well as they should have been in this company. I mean, they were so great in Impact Wrestling for so long. And I just don't think we've seen even, you know, a fifth of what they can do. I mean, they are so much better than this. So I was a little bit disappointed by the response. Didn't they feel like the match really got going? And considering these two guys were in there having suffered terrible injuries that were inflicted by, you know, Moxley had done this to Santana, and obviously Jericho, Santana's ally, had done this to Moxley. I thought it should have had more heat than it did. You know, obviously Moxley won again. He had to, because he's facing Jericho at the pay-per-view. And then, as you said, the Inner Circle inevitably ran in, beat up Jon Moxley. Jericho hit a pretty piss poor looking Judas effect, actually. Then Jeff Cobb come out at the end. I thought they did a really good job of concealing how short he is, because, you know, the whole way they shot him with Jake Hagar, because he's really tall, as we know, and Cobb looked really powerful. They were putting him over like a million bucks on commentary. My God, they were putting him over. Did a sterling job there of making him seem like a somebody. And yeah, planted Moxley. That looked really good. And you were just, you know, we were talking earlier about Jake Hagar being kind of effortless. And he was like doing this thing where he's sort of kneeling and he's got like his fist on his jaw. He's like posing, like, you know, just like gloating. That was really funny. And it was, yeah, I mean, it was, we've kind of seen stuff like this before, but it all makes sense. And it's, you know, it's all a tit for tat thing. How will Moxley respond on next week's episode of Dynamite? That's what we will be tuning in to see.
And they've, you know, they've got a stat show next week. They've got Moxley against Jeff Cobb. They've got the cage match with Cody and Wardlow. They've got a tag title match with Paige and Omega against the Lucha Brothers, the Battle Royal. So, you know, I think they're doing a decent enough job of building matches for the following week. The downside to that will be, how long can you do that for before you've given all your matches away, which is something I know you've brought up before. After you'd watched both these shows, did you think there was a clear winner in the ratings after you'd watched it?
I think probably, I mean, AEW's been on, is it about 6 or 7 week win streak now?
Since they came back from the New Year break, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Dynamite will draw the larger viewing audience. It feels like they've settled in, you know, they're doing like 800,000 plus, NXT's in the 700,000 range. Charlotte didn't really make a whole lot of difference last week, did she, to the number? And that was quite well promoted by WWE on Raw, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. The only time they've really been able to beat them and win was when they've had the main roster people, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, maybe now they've got Velveteen Dream back. We'll see if that makes much difference. I don't know whether WWE or NXT's really trying that hard to beat AEW in the ratings, because they could load up the shows a lot more than they do and give a lot more away than they have done on NXT to attract more viewers. I don't know whether it's such a big thing to them. I'm not sure if it is. I think maybe they're kind of happy with what they're doing right now and they're playing the long game, which is, you know, we've said from the start, that's what this is. It's the long game. And in many ways, they're better off just preserving what they've got, drawing, you know, 700,000 plus. Okay, they're not beating Dynamite, but it's a decent number for the third brand. And, you know, all these talents are getting a lot of exposure. They're reaching a much bigger audience than they were prior to September of last year when NXT started on USA. So I don't know whether it's such a big thing to WWE. If it was, I think we'd see a lot more main roster traffic going down to NXT. That's my theory.
Yeah.
One last thing, Kenny, sorry, about Dynamite. I thought Britt Baker did a really good job on her heel promo. She had tremendous heat out there. That must have been music to her ears.
She's doing great in that when she was doing all the dentist chat and she's talking about what she was doing last week and seeing all the fans, like the Whataburger people, absolutely tremendous. But yeah, well, listen, in a few weeks hopefully we'll do another swap so we can talk about the shows again, because it's fun to hear you get to have a take on these shows and Sondra get to have a take on Raw and SmackDown. So we will revisit this switch around again at some point soon, I think.
Yes, definitely.
What are your plugs, Finn, as we go off into the podcast sunset?
Not well, just my website, finleymartin.co.uk. You know, you can buy Powerslam t-shirts. Obviously, people know about my books. My Twitter is at Finley Martin. My Facebook's at Finley Martin. I think that's all the plugs I have. How about yourself, Kenny?
Well, for me, just to keep it short and sweet, if you want to get more content, interview content, video interview content, go to youtube.com/InsideTheRopes. We're up to over 139,000 subscribers. The road to 150 is on. And also, you can buy tickets to come see Kenny Omega, who we just talked about in this show, one half of the AEW World Tag Team Champions in April in Glasgow and London, inside the ropes.co.uk/Omega. Thank you everybody for all your support. Also, head over to Patreon if you want this 24 hours early and bonus content with us, and pay-per-view reviews, retro pay-per-view reviews, interviews, a written interview with JR is going up soon. Patreon.
That will, can I just say that will go up next week?
Next week, which is going to be... I've heard some of the stuff that's in there, and it's stuff that JR doesn't normally get asked. I'm looking forward to it. Patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. So Finn, I hope you enjoy the rest of your week.
And you as well, Kenny. I look forward to recording with you next week. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.